There are lots of different kinds of literature in the Bible. There are boring, boring legal texts and repetitive history chunks that you think when you're in the middle of Chronicles, you're thinking, didn't I read this in Kings a while back? Yes, you did. It's a rerun. There is erotic love poetry. There is legal documents. There are letters. There's lots of poetry. And there's also just very cool short stories. And those are some of my favorites. Jonah is one of my favorites. Even though it's listed in the prophets, it's actually a short story. And I think it was written by Woody Allen. And it's pretty wonderful. Another short story is one called Ruth. And another one you might want to check out sometime is Esther. Those are both very, very cool. Ruth is a delightful story that I would encourage you sometime this week. If you have a half an hour, you can sit down and read the book of Ruth. It'll take less time than watching something on TV. And you get a lot more out of it. Because it's just a wonderful story about a couple of women who in a really difficult place, in a very patriarchal and aggressive culture, eke out a life leaning on each other and leaning on the love of God. Unlike some other books in the Old Testament, God's presence is not in storms and earthquakes and lightning and plagues and stuff. God is just kind of quietly in the background, present, but not telling people what to do. God doesn't converse with anybody. People have to walk like we do, prayerfully and in faith, but not always knowing what the next step is. So I put down some highlights of Ruth here, and I'm going to read them to you. But know that there's a lot of other stuff going on here that you should take a look at yourself. It doesn't quite start out once upon a time. It starts out in the days, which is kind of the same thing. In the days when the judges ruled, there was a famine in the land, and a certain man of Bethlehem in Judah went to live in the country of Moab. Now, it's important to know that Moab was enemies with Israel. That was where all the bad people lived. But when there's a famine, you go where there's food. He and his wife and two sons. The name of the man was Elimelech, and the name of the wife, Naomi. The names of his two sons were Mahlon and Chilion, and they were Ephrathites from Bethlehem in Judah. And then they went into the country of Moab and remained there. But Elimelech, the husband of Naomi, died and was left with her two sons. These took Moabite wives. The name of one was Orpah. By the way, Oprah Winfrey, her mother named her after Orpah. Not quite correctly, but it works. And the name of the other was Ruth. When they had lived there about 10 years, both Mahlon and Chilion also died, so that the woman was left without her two sons and her husband. So this is the first paragraph of the whole book. I mean, it sets up a whole lot of life and a whole lot of death, but it's really just the setup for the real story that begins after that. I skip a few paragraphs and come here. Then Naomi started to return with her daughters-in-law from the country of Moab, for she had heard in the country of Moab that the Lord had considered his people and had given them food. So the famine is over in Israel, and she's decided to go back home to where she has family and can be supported. Naomi said to her two daughters-in-law, "Go back, each of you, to your mother's house. May the Lord deal kindly with you as you have dealt with the dead and with me." Orpah plays it smart and heads back to her mother's home. But Ruth said, "Do not press me to leave you or turn back from following you. Where you go, I will go. Where you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die. There I will be buried. May Yahweh do thus and so to me and more as well if even death parts me from you." When Naomi saw that she was determined to go with her, she said no more to her. So they get back to Bethlehem, and they're eking out a very difficult living. Ruth is gleaning in the fields. Gleaning is when the workers go through the field and they're told to not get super aggressive with picking stuff. You're not supposed to pick anything around the borders of the field and not be too crazy, because then the poor are allowed to come through and pick what's fallen on the ground and everything that's left around the borders. And so Ruth is gleaning out in the field as a poor person, getting the leftovers. She finds that she's been gleaning in the field of a person who's a relative of Naomi's, named Boaz, who's the owner of the field. And Ruth decides this might be a good match, these two, Ruth and Boaz. And she does some scheming to help make that happen. And in the most aggressive, I don't know, aggressive is the wrong word, but in the most serious bit of linking these two, Naomi says to her, Naomi, her mother-in-law, says to Ruth, "My daughter, I need to seek some security for you so that it may be well with you. Now, here is our kinsman Boaz, with whose young women you have been working. See, he is winnowing barley tonight at the threshing floor. Now, wash yourself and anoint yourself and put on your best clothes and go down to the threshing floor, but do not make yourself known to the man until he has finished eating and drinking. When he lies down, observe the place where he lies, and then go, uncover his feet and lie down, and he will tell you what to do." She said to her, "All that you tell me, I will do." Which is a strange story until you realize that in Hebrew, feet are a euphemism for more intimate body parts. And then it makes all the sense in the world because you realize this is a seduction. We'll skip a few paragraphs that are PG rated. And it goes like this. So Boaz took Ruth, and she became his wife. When they came together, the Lord made her conceive, and she bore a son. And then the women said to Naomi, "Blessed be Yahweh, who has not left you this day without next of kin, and may his name be renowned in Israel. He shall be to you a restorer of life and a nourisher of your old age. For your daughter-in-law who loves you, who is more worth more to you than seven sons, has borne him." Then Naomi took the child and laid him in her bosom and became his nurse. The women of the neighborhood gave him a name, saying, "A son has been born to Naomi." They named him Obed, and he became the father of Jesse, who became the father of David. There's another delightful story also of a widow, also trying to survive in a difficult environment. This happens in Jesus' final week of life in Jerusalem. He's teaching in the temple. As Jesus taught, he said, "Beware of the scribes who like to walk around in long robes and be greeted with respect in the marketplace and have the best seats in the synagogues and places of honor at banquets. They devour women's houses and for the sake of appearance say long prayers. They will receive the greater condemnation." He sat down opposite the temple treasury and watched the crowd putting money into the treasury. Many rich people put in large sums. A poor widow came and put in two small copper coins. The Roman coin was called a lepton, which are worth a penny. And actually, that's pretty close. If you're making minimum wage, a lepton was worth about a penny. It's about 1 minute's labor. Then he called his disciples and said to them, "Truly I tell you, this poor widow has put in more than all those who are contributing to the treasury, for all of them have contributed out of their abundance, but she, out of her poverty, has put in everything she had, all she had to live on." They say you only get one chance to make a first impression. I think that's probably true. And I have made some very bad first impressions in my life. There's this weird thing in some cities that allows you to make a lot of first impressions, good, well, or badly, in very short time. Barb and I have a friend who went to a speed dating evening one night at a bar in Boston several years ago. Have you heard of these speed dating things? I'm not sure if they're still done. This was a decade or more ago. So you have a herd of single women are arranged at tables, and a herd of single men make a circuit around the tables, and they have, depending on the venue, around 3 or 5 minutes to sit down, have a micro date, a speed date, where they make a good first impression, or as best a first impression as they can. And then, as the evening goes on, the women check off the men who made a good impression with them, and the men take a check on the women who made a good impression to them. And if those people who you said made a good impression on you also thought you made a good impression on them, then you get the contact information for that other people, and you can have a hopefully slightly longer second date. It seems like a great place for charming predators to do quite well. But now the idea behind it is that you can avoid, say, 12 weeks of awkward blind dates with 12 awkward different people by doing one intense night of concentrated first impressions with 12 different people. Of course, if there are no mutual impressions made, you go home with your ego decimated. But it's one night of intense ego decimation rather than 6 months of vague angst about what a loser you are. So maybe it's worth it. Our friend tried it once. He said the pressure was excruciating. The life stories were as well rehearsed as a TED talk. The emotional masks that people wore of being successful and having their stuff together could not be removed. Our friend hated it. It was fake, 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 fake. But he got a chance to make a whole bunch of first impressions. But here's the thing about first impressions. They're almost always wrong. Take our story from the book of Ruth. When you look at the first paragraph, the story gets set up. What is your first impression of Naomi in the first paragraph of this book? What nouns, what adjectives come to mind? There's a famine. She loses her husband. She loses her sons. What adjectives come to mind?
Tragedy.
She's a tragic figure. Lonely?
Unlucky.
Pathetic. A victim of circumstance. It's a
vulnerable.
Passive, even. That's the first impression. We see Naomi and her three daughters, or her two daughters-in-law, Ruth and Orpah, as three widows with no men in their immediate families, which in that culture meant that they had no source of support or shelter or even food. They're completely without social standing in a foreign land, a standing that when her husband and sons die, her standing is so stripped away that the author calls Naomi the woman, stripping her even of her name. She's a non-person. That's the end of the first paragraph. That's our first impression. But as we go into the story, we realize that first impression of Naomi is wrong. As we read through the short story, this non-person doesn't sit on an anthill and weep. She takes action. She is proactive. She decides, I'm going back to Bethlehem. I'm going to go back to my husband's clan and make a future for myself. And when she makes that decision, the author gives her back her name. She starts being called Naomi again. And Naomi speaks to her daughters-in-law. Now, Ruth and Orpah are from this foreign enemy country of Moab. They don't expect they will be welcomed in Judah. No Judean man would marry them. So Naomi, stating the obvious fact that she can no longer provide husbands at her age for these two daughters-in-law, sends them home to their own families. Orpah takes her advice and leaves. A sensible action, given what's gone on in her life. But Ruth refuses and pledges her undying commitment to Naomi. And that beautiful poem, "Where you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. Your God will be my God, your people my people." There in the wilderness, Ruth declares her love for Naomi, her mother-in-law, in stark terms of life and death. Naomi is speechless, and after a while, they resume their journey together. Two widows traveling toward Judah. Ruth's pledge of undying commitment to Naomi is one of the Bible's best example of a Hebrew word we've shared before, chesed, which is translated in the King James as loving kindness, in more modern translations as steadfast love or covenant love or covenant steadfastness or covenant commitment. It's a very ripe word. It describes the love you have for someone because you have committed yourself to that person. Chesed is a term used for God's commitment to Israel, that no matter what, God will not stop loving these people, even when they turn away. It's a committed love that just will not quit. It's a love you can count on, even when you can't see it or feel it. You know it's there underneath it all. It's a love you can count on. But it doesn't mean you're passive either. Naomi and Ruth, depending on the chesed of one to another and also on the steadfast love of God that's in that background of theirs, they are determined to make their future work against some steep odds, and they take some bold actions. Naomi decides to return to Judah after all the years she's been away, a move that had to entail swallowing some pride. Ruth decides to go with Naomi, a move that requires her to throw away everything she's known in her home country in favor of a future she can't predict among a foreign people. Once they are back in Judah, Ruth doesn't just live off the generosity of her adopted family, but immediately goes to work in the fields and works with Naomi to pick and find and ultimately seduce some good husband material named Boaz. It sounds like a lot of scheming, yes? And it is. And it's a great example of taking two small, powerless people, taking what little life has given them and taking it and trusting in God to help make it happen. These two women are strengthened by the chesed of their commitment to each other, and by the chesed that they know God has for them, to manage to create a bright future that most folks would have predicted only sorrow and suffering coming from. Our first impression of these two women are they are victims, and they are tragic and passive. And first impressions are almost always wrong. There's another important point besides first impressions not being very accurate, is that's the scale of the story. The story begins with there's a famine. Now, famines are big things that cause kings to fall and political realignments to happen. There's this ecological catastrophe that causes who knows how many deaths, but the story goes, it doesn't talk about kings, it doesn't talk about princes, it doesn't talk about armies that had to be doing stuff because of a bad famine. it just narrows in onto this small scale. God works with two powerless women to create a new reality, one that will lead not only to the birth of a son, Obed, but to the birth of a king named David. And ultimately, 27 generations later, to the birth of whom?
Jesus.
Jesus. God operates small here. Ruth and Naomi make the choice to stay faithful to God without any obvious signs from the heavens. There's no burning bush. There's no voice from the skies. There's no vision of God's promise to them. There's no voice at all. God is a major player in this story, but God is on the sidelines, behind the curtains, behind the everyday, ordinary experiences and activities that make up Ruth and Naomi's ordinary lives. Instead of lightning bolts, we hear God in Ruth's profession of love to Naomi. Instead of miracles, we find God in Boaz's care for Ruth as she gleans from his fields. And in the hope of her newborn son at the end of the story, who becomes the grandfather to King David. Great-grandfather. That is the special joy of the book of Ruth. It's not about kings. It's not about great religious leaders. It's not about saints who are never tempted to sin. It's about ordinary, small people caught in tough times, doing the best they can with what little they have to make a future confident in God's presence. Ruth and Naomi have to act on their faith in the same way we do. Very few of us have a voice from God. Very few of us have lightning bolts or burning bushes. We have quiet reflection that we pray might give us a hint of the next half step to go forward. Not knowing exactly what the next move ought to be, these two women live in faith that God is with them, even when they don't hear the voice, and that is enough. The gospel story is also about God working in a person whose first impressions are not very impressive. When we see this widow, especially in the context of Jesus talking about the scribes, who were the guys who wrote contracts and devour widows' houses, here comes this widow with nothing. Maybe she's precisely the kind of person Jesus was talking about. Just like with Naomi, we think victim. We think passive. We think pathetic. We think sad. But check this scene out. That first impression is wrong. Jesus watches big players with big egos and big paychecks giving big golden gifts to the temple budget. Now, it's a great scene if you're an extrovert. The temple treasury boxes were in the area called the courtyard of the women. This was the second. It's a concentric set of walls. There's the court of the Gentiles, where foreigners can go, but no further than that. Then there's the court of the women, where Jewish women are allowed to come. Then there's the court of the men, and then you get into the more sacred areas where the priests hang out. So this is in the court of the women, which would have a mix of Jewish men and Jewish women. And there were these trumpet-shaped, like money drains, I guess would be accurate. They're a trumpet-shaped or flower-shaped cone. And you would come, and with you got all these people hanging out and watching, and you're like coming up with your bushel basket of silver coins. Thank you, thank you. I'm fabulous. Yes. People can see what you're doing. Jesus can watch all these guys with all the big bank accounts coming by, and then he's able to see this widow coming up with a couple of leptons. I had some leptons that I showed the kids 6 or 7 years ago, and I can't find them now. But they're little tiny copper things, and they're just not worth anything. You can buy them now from a dealer for $1.50, and they're 2,000 years old, and they're amazing, but they're so plentiful and so common that even nowadays are not worth anything. The first impression is she's not much of an example of anything. But first impressions are wrong. Jesus lifts this woman, this widow, this poor person who puts a paltry couple of copper coins in the coffers, and lifts her up as the example of giving, of what it means to give back to God. And it shows that in a world that worships big, and we love big first impressions, God seems, once again, to value small. There's a peculiar trait about us human critters. Is that when things are going well, when we're living large, when all is big and smooth and looking up, instead of seeing life and love and health and blessing as an amazing, undeserved gift, we start thinking, we earned all this stuff. I love friends of mine from high school who are doing quite well. And they'll put these memes on Facebook. My friend Kevin has a meme on there. And what he says is true enough, is that, you know, if you work hard, you'll be successful like me, and if you don't work hard, you'll be a loser like people who are on welfare. And it's really an attack on poor people. And then when I call him gently on it, saying, you know, Kevin, I remember your house. You had a really nice house, and your dad was pretty successful, and he paid for you to go to school, and you had a lot of advantages. And yeah, you're hardworking, and you're a good engineer, and you're doing great stuff, and he runs a construction company really, really well. Awesome. But don't pretend you invented the thing. Don't invent that this was not a gift. And that you had some benefits by being an upper middle class white guy with a college education. Because I know lots of really hard working people who are pulling down 3 and 4 part-time jobs and are working harder than me, and working harder than Kevin, and they are not making it. Your wealth does not have anything to do with how hard you're working. We start to think we earned all this. If I'm doing well, I start thinking I deserve all this. Because I work harder, or think smarter, or I'm just more fabulous than someone else, I deserve it. It is not true. I don't. Do I work hard? Yeah. Do I deserve the blessings I have? No. That's why they're called blessings. I wanted to share a quick video from a guy whose first impression will not be very impressive. He's a guy who looked like he might be a street person, and you don't know who he is based on what he says here, so I'll let you know who it is. This is a guy who was, up until last year, the president of Uruguay, a country in South America. Back in the very bad old 70s and 80s, he was a revolutionary fighter fighting against a brutal right-wing dictatorship. He was arrested, put in jail for 14 years, 7 of which were in solitary confinement. When the days of the generals were over, he was elected president. And he wasn't like a regular president. He donated 90% of his salary to charity. He lived on $799 a month. He didn't live in the presidential palace. He lived in the cabin on his wife's farm. He drives a 1978 Volkswagen Beetle. And when he shows up in Germany for a funeral, he's wearing the same peasant outfit he wears when he's wandering the streets of Uruguay. He has no use for any of the trappings of power, of privilege, of authority. And he has some interesting observations about our relationship to stuff. Bob? Might need a second click.
Más de 10 años de soledad en el calabozo. Y tuvimos tiempo, tuvimos 7 años sin leer un libro. Y tuvimos mucho tiempo para pensar. Y descubrimos esto. O logras ser feliz con poco y liviano de equipaje, porque la felicidad está dentro tuyo, o no logras nada. Esto no es una apología de la pobreza. Esto es una apología de la sobriedad. Pero como hemos inventado una sociedad de consumo, consumista, y la economía tiene que crecer, porque si no crece es una tragedia, inventamos una montaña de consumo superfluo. Y hay que tirar y vivir comprando y tirando. Y lo que estamos gastando es tiempo de vida. Porque cuando yo compro algo, o tú, no lo compras con plata. Lo compras con el tiempo de vida que tuviste que gastar para tener esa plata. Pero con esta diferencia. La única cosa que no se puede comprar es la vida. La vida se gasta. Y es miserable gastar la vida para perder libertad.
Wow. I'm not advocating poverty. I'm advocating sobriety about our relationship with stuff. I and my iPhone 6 might need to think about that a little bit, huh? Being small, like the widow, like Ruth and Naomi, being small, like the 2 copper coins, lets you know that our blessings are not our own making. Being small lets me know that my source comes from elsewhere. Being small helps us recognize that everything that comes our way is a gift, a miraculous gift. From the sunrise in the morning to the startling cold of the first snowfall of the season on your tongue, from the grumpy good morning of the person you love and need to take care of, to the paycheck that everyone from Agway to Washington, D.C. wants a piece of, it's all a gift. The mountaintop experiences are a gift. The dark valleys are a gift. And every morning can be an opportunity to wake up to, wow, a new day. Thank you. Thank you. That's how we get to faith. That's how we get to thanks. That's how we get to joy. I think small is a much better way to get to faith than big. Because when we come with the smallness of the widow and the smallness of Ruth and Naomi, we can't pretend we earned it. We can't pretend we earned our way to grace. It is a gift. It is joy. It is thanksgiving. I shared a story our first fall here. So I'll repeat it. Maybe you don't remember it. The pastor of Grace UMC in St. Johnsbury told me that in his first year at that church, would have been around 1985 or so, a working single mom with one daughter who was on public assistance, came to the church office the first Monday of January with a check for the church equal to 1/10 of her meager income for the year. And he wouldn't take it. And he tried to talk her out of it. "You can't afford this," he said. "You and your daughter need this money more than this church needs the money. It's your lifeline." And she gave him a scathing look and said, "No, Pastor, you should know better. I know who my lifeline is. And this is how I say thank you for it all." He took the check. First impressions are always wrong. When we come to God small, we put all our trust in God's presence, God's steadfast chesed, trusting in our gut that God loves us where we are and how we are. And when we come to God small, we know it's God's knowledge, God's power, God's trustworthiness that will do amazing things in our lives. In us, through us, and with us, God's strength is perfected in our weakness, as Paul says in 2 Corinthians 12. Small is good because it teaches us who we are and whose we are as we journey along the way with God.